have the Soviet Union. We have Japan, now the third power in the world economically, and actually, so you've got five great economic powers. Now let me go back to 53 and compare it to 1971 in terms of the political military situation. Politically, militarily, then we had no relations with mainland China and no expectation of having we had a situation where, as far as the Soviet Union was concerned, there was relatively little negotiation, very little prospect. We were building up our power, and they were building up their power. The Marshall Plan, NATO, etc., were absolute essentials for us as long as they were taking rather aggressive monetary orders from Western Europe. Situation today is changed. Not changed perhaps as much as those who tend to be euphoric in times like this, not nearly as much as would appear by some of the cosmetics, but nevertheless significantly changed. What we find is that we not only have the entity of Western Europe, which is an economic giant, militarily modest in its power, politically, it will be radical. We have the Soviet Union, and then looking at the difference between the United States and the Soviet Union, our relations now and then, moving from a period of outright confrontation to a period of negotiation, not meaning that the situation has changed insofar as the kind of a world they want and the kind of a world we want. They still are, as they would be the first to admit, they are still the protagonists of a communist world. They have given up, certainly, at least publicly and so forth, on the idea of expanding through military adventures, where those military adventures might involve them in any kind of confrontation with the United States. But nevertheless, here we find that with the Soviet Union, we are moving into negotiation on arms control with some prospect for success beginning this year. Some prospect for success, nothing is sure, but it's moving along. We are negotiating on Berlin, which was a very, very problem in 53 and has had been the source of a crisis a half a dozen times since 53. Some major, some, and many more small ones. We have the prospect of negotiation further down the road on mutual balance force reduction between the NATO and the Warsaw powers. And then, of course, we are talking with the Soviet about an area like the Mideast, where we do not directly confront each other, but where our peripheral interests are so substantial that if we rub against each other, it could bust burst into flame. So we see the United States moving toward a more outgoing policy toward the Soviet Union and toward Eastern Europe. Not small, but some trade beginning with certain countries in Eastern Europe. When the Vietnam War ends, it will mean then that not only Yugoslavia, but countries like Romania and Poland, Hungary, etc., will move into a situation where there will be more trade with the United States, more confrontation, and of course the Soviet Union as well, moves at that point. At that point is coming very, very rapidly, as we know. What I'm suggesting here, just parenthetically, is that as the Vietnam War ends, the restrictions that necessarily must be imposed on certain items because the war can then be relaxed, that we can see the possibilities of more contact, of more trade, and more competition. Japan, we've already talked about. Everybody knows how it's moving along economically, and people will cover that substantially in history class. Then we look at the Chinese situation. On the one side, and very properly so, it's a hopeful thing. Hopeful in the sense that it's getting out of need. Let's put it this way. Chinese are power, the communist power, like the Soviet Union, with very different ideas about the world than we have. On the other hand, as we look down the road, not 1 year, 3, 4, 5 years from now, but 15 or 20 years from now, you're going to see an economic giant. And of course, with 800 million people, and 900 million, and 100 million, and a billion people, a great military power in the world. Under those circumstances, to have that nation outside of the world community, without contact with the world community, would be a danger that would be unacceptable to us, and I may suggest unacceptable to the Soviet Union. And the irony is that the United States is the nation at this point that must prove that its destiny to play the role, to begin to bring that nation into the world community. Doesn't mean it's going to happen fast. Doesn't mean there's going to be a great deal of problems in the rest. We hope for that. Speculate beyond it, except to say that what we have done here is, I think, well understood in that respect. Because if you look down the road 20 years, we could have an airtight arms control agreement with the Soviet Union. And we can even not only limit arms, we might even move toward reducing arms and reducing forces to move the nuclear balance forces in Europe and the rest. We can have all that, and 20 years from now, the Soviet Union, the United States, Europe, Japan, all agree. What difference does it make standing this one nation outside the club? That showed you, and that demonstrates to us, of course, why this is an issue. Therefore, while it should lead to no euphoria, it is a necessary step, in our view, that needs to be taken for the reasons I mentioned in my brief announcement last week. Now, so many could look at this and say how hopeful the world really is. We're reducing tensions with Eastern Europe, and we're negotiating with the Soviet, where we'll have more contact. No question about it. It's going to be a world which will be more contact. And looking at Asia over a period of time, there will be some reduction of tension. And there will be beginning to be the contact with this great mass of people who live on mainland China. And so, in a sense, the military danger in the world, the military challenge in the world, let's not call it a danger, that becomes perhaps in the future not as alarming as it would be at the present time if these initiatives had not been undertaken, or at least were not in the wings. But by the same token, ironically, as the world, as we begin to reduce, and we all would welcome this, to the extent we are successful, and we trust we will be successful, not only this administration, but whoever succeeds us in this place, in reducing these military areas of confrontation, reducing them only as our interests will allow them to be, as we are successful in having more communication, more contact, the economic challenge enormously escalates. That's just the tool for it. Now, Pete will not, of course, cover what the world's going to be 5 years from now. Nobody knows. But what we are trying to do, through a meeting with very few select leaders in the Senate and some in the House, is to present to you, on a bipartisan basis, the challenge economically that the United States faces in the period of the 70s. How many jobs we have to have, and where we're going to get them. How we're going to compete in the world, how we're going to be more productive in the world. And I would simply close my opening remarks by saying this. As I sit here, just as President Eisenhower sat here, and I am sure Wilson was behind the screen, Teddy Roosevelt many years before, every president who sits here, our first concern needs to be, and must necessarily be, creating the structure of peace which will either end war or avoid it. And I think we now are making progress in that direction. But looking further down the road, as the world becomes more peaceful from a military standpoint, it will become infinitely more competitive and more challenging. different states have it its own way. No longer do we be number one simply because we are the biggest and the strongest and the best. We are the biggest, we are the strongest, and we are the best still. And, no, and I don't go for all this malarkey to the effect that because we've fallen back in this area or that area or the other one, that the United States worker, the United States businessman and so forth can't do as well or better than the Japanese or the German or anybody else in the world. But on the other hand, I think we have to realize that when we look at our nation, who are we? We came from all the nations of the world. And it's because of our system of government, because of our competitive instincts and everything else that we've done as well as we have. But as we look at this world in the future, we can see it very clearly now. Here's a strong Western Europe, built up, as a matter of fact, through our aid. We helped our enemies, and here they are, our major competitors. Germany, Europe, Japan, of course, in Asia. We have Japan, of course, in Asia. We've got, and then the two communist superpowers, the Soviet Union and China, and then, of course, the lesser powers in those areas. Having mentioned these, of course, I haven't covered, and there's no need to go into the great potential of Latin America, which is down the road, and Africa, and the Middle East, and the South Asia, because for the next 20 years or so, the big game economic growth from the industrial standpoint will be defined, that we presently have mentioned. So that, to me, is the world's thing, where that, to me, is one of the reasons that this presentation by Pete Peterson, I think, is the most timely and perhaps the most significant briefing that you may hear around this table in the many years you've been here. Because it looks far to the future. We must plan now for what we do to make America competitive, to keep it competitive, to make it competitive and keep it competitive, not because we're trying to beat anybody else down or so forth, but because we simply want this nation in this period of time to retain its vigor, its strength for us, to not simply just die, as we very well might, unless we look to all of our sources of strength to die into a second-rate position in the world. We're not there now. We don't pretend to be, but we're going to need a lot of thinking in life, bipartisan support, the best thinking that you can possibly provide to avoid that happening. So now with that, Pete, if you could take over and get a little bit of a projection. You don't avoid any conflict of interest here. Thanks, sir.
Thank you,
Mr.
President.
Thank you, Mayor. You'll learn something from these guys. You're fellow experts. You better be at your best today. Gentlemen, I look out of the audience and see Carl Curtis there, who knows that, like he, I guess, I was born in a small town in Nebraska, and when you were introduced by the president in overly gracious ways, you better cut yourself down to size. There's a story, you know, of the small town hotshot that ends up in the White House, and everybody in this small town is very proud and verbal about this young man's accomplishments, except one old man who perhaps knows him best of all. And his comment was about this young man, well, he may know a lot, but he doesn't realize nothing. And I'm going to present a lot of facts to you today, and we'll leave it to you to decide what I realize. But anyway, since this is a bipartisan group, you might be interested in what Adlai Stevenson said about foreign economic policy about 20 years ago. He said, at the very least, it was a field that needed some new cliches. And as we hear about protectionism and free trade and things of that sort, I have a feeling that we really need to not only come up with some new language, but some new ideas about what kind of a world we're living in. Chuck, I have a lot of ambivalence about whether I want this damn thing to work or not. Let's start by looking at the world's
decline. We would expect it in the 50s. It's declined somewhat more in the 60s. Still obviously the largest power in the world. One can't help but be impressed by the impressive growth of the community. If you will now add the United Kingdom to that and the other countries, it's rapidly approaching 20% of the world's GNP. We can perhaps also get some lessons by looking at the countries that haven't done so well. Notice the significant decline in the United Kingdom, in Britain. In the last 10 years alone, it has lost 25% of its share of GNP. The less developed part of the world is holding reasonably flat, frankly, gentlemen, a lot of that is oil production. Certainly, one of the major stories here must be the dramatic growth of Japan. It has doubled its share of the gross national product, its share of the gross national product of the last 10 years, and now accounts for over 6%. The president referred to China, and I find this a rather interesting comparison. In 1950, only 20 years ago, China had about 3 times the share of GNP as Japan did. Today, only 20 years later, the Japanese, with 1/8 of the people, have a 50% larger share. What about the Japanese story, about which I'll comment more a little later? There are 2 or 3 facts that I'd like you to keep in mind that I think help explain this phenomenal growth. The first is, this is an economy that puts a much larger share of its gross national product into investment in plant equipment. For example, at the present time, it's putting about 39% of its GNP into investment. That compares to the United States, about 18%, European countries, about 25%. About 3/4 of its plant equipment is less than 6 years old. It is spending only 0.8% of its GNP on defense, which certainly has helped provide the funds for this investment. Quite remarkably, about 20% of what the consumers earn is saved, and that provides another source for this great investment in its economic future. I'm not going to engage in any predictions about Japan in the next 20 years. We've got a lot of Japanologists around the world these days. There are some who predict that Japan will pass the United States in per capita income in 20 years and in total GNP by the year 2000. Russia, as you can see, has moved up only